Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Ann Beattie, whose latest book is The New Yorker Stories. Ann Beattie is also the author of several novels and collections of stories. Novels include Perfect Recall and Chilly Scenes of Winter, and also recently a novella that was published as a book called Walks with Men. Let me start by asking you why a book of just stories from The New Yorker, because as time went on, you began publishing more with other publications. We're getting kind of a partway look at the history of Ann Beattie, but it's not a full look because it's heavy-weighted toward the earlier stories.
It is. I don't know that I would have thought of this except that I was in a bookstore and I saw a book called, I think, The American Woman Writer in Her Time by Elaine Showalter. And, of course, I flipped to the back to see if I was mentioned. And, in fact, she had counted up the number of short stories I had in The New Yorker during a 10-year period. And apparently I had the record for that particular 10-year period. And that's what made me think about it. The belt notch is always the same. At least I'm not gaining weight. But I really had no reason to have counted my New Yorker stories. And I thought, well, maybe sociologically even, that's interesting, you know, what the New Yorker published over a period of time.
Who were your editors over the years?
My only editor was Roger Angel from the very beginning straight through. I guess maybe for the last two or three stories, in that he is no longer the senior fiction editor at the New Yorker. I think I had one with Bill Buford. I think I've had two with Deborah Treisman, who's currently the fiction editor of The New Yorker, whom I've never met, but, you know, that's who I've worked with.
And how do you feel about, say, the work of Roger Angel compared to, since you had so many with him, compared to the work of other editors you've had both at The New Yorker or elsewhere?
I'll tell you one thing. Roger taught me so much about looking at my writing carefully and from a distance just to make sure that it was really convincing and as simply put as possible and existing on a factual level, even though it's fiction. You know, he taught me how to follow something through, to follow a detail through, how to reinforce things, how to edit succinctly. And so my writing style was so helped by Roger that really I integrated all of that, and it was always an advantage to me, even if I was working with somebody different.
When you got those criticisms, then you'd rewrite the story? How did that work?
The New Yorker wouldn't really, in those days, and I'm really not up on right. How the New Yorker operates now, but in those days, certainly the New Yorker wouldn't have bought anything that needed to be highly edited, if you know what I mean. They simply would have passed on it. And I also had the amazing advantage, now that I look back, I know this, of really physically sitting there at Roger's side. I sat there beside his desk while he edited with a pencil and was able to watch his mind working at the same time that I was seeing what I thought was in the story that needed to be more brought up to the surface.
You'd be talking and he'd be making corrections.
Exactly.
And you'd
right.
be asking, what are you doing, why, and he would explain.
Oh my
what
goodness,
it was.
I, you know, the man is brilliant. It was apparent what he was doing when he made the edits, and of course he was talking a bit under his breath or saying, what do you think about, what should you do here that you haven't done here, and so forth. But again, and I don't mean to discredit Roger, but it was work that he was fine-tuning. And I think that, therefore, he and I were looking at it the same way. It's just that he was much better at his job than I was at the final stages of my job, which was to act as an editor, not just a writer.
And so eventually you just, you know, kind of channeled Roger as
Indeed.
You would do a reworking of the story.
Indeed, I did, yes.
The stories themselves, you've been called a chronicler of the baby boomer because those early stories wander, the characters wander around, they don't know where they're going, they're mostly in their 20s, they smoke a lot of weed, drink quite a bit. As the years change, we begin to see married couples mostly breaking up, as well as children, and then we get to the later stories. And the last stories in the book, the last two stories, involve older men, and the points of view begin to shift more from women of a certain age, being Ann Beattie's age, to men and women of different ages. I mean, what was going on in your mind as the progression happened?
For one thing, of course, I was living my life and I was also getting older. And so, you know, it wasn't a preconceived notion in any way, but I consider any material that I get into fair, as long as it still holds surprises for me. One way you can always make yourself be surprised is to write from the point of view of, say, a much older man. That just makes an automatic difference, you know. But for the beginning part of your question, you know, when I was in my 20s and I was writing for The New Yorker, it's not that I thought these characters were going towards something and then they sort of got derailed. It was more about the fact that we were somewhere when we were in our 20s and we were all living our lives. And I was in my 20s in the late 60s, early 70s, and there was no looking toward the future. We felt then we were changing society in the moment. And really, in some ways, I would say we did. We did. Maybe not the world's best job or exactly what we should commend ourselves for exclusively, but it wasn't as though I was looking at people who had merely dropped out of society and that's where it ended. I was looking at people who envisioned their future in no other terms, how to work outside the system. I still feel that I work outside the system as much as I can.
Anne Beattie, in looking at those early stories, as I was reading them and the stories began to blur, the sense I got, though, was that each character, even in the shortest stories, is fully formed in a way that we rarely see in short stories, and that's very rare.
Well, thank you. You know, sometimes you see these anthologies of sudden fiction or something like that, extremely short stories, but one story leaps to mind. There's a story by Mary Robeson that was published in The New Yorker called Yours, and it all takes place on one page. I mean, when I saw that little carrot at the end of the story, I almost fainted. It certainly is a masterpiece. So, you know, it's a very, very hard thing to do, to write a story that is so evocative in so few words, and she certainly outdid me with that one. I can think of individual stories that do that, but I understand what you're saying generally, and I would say that in some ways, really, it's maybe not entirely a question of who the characters are that get revealed as they do, but an authority of tone that maybe was more disarming when I came up with that tone for my work than in later years, in more recent years.
Then those early ones, by the fourth paragraph, we know the character, but then, even though we've learned the character, the story will take us in turns we didn't expect and not necessarily lead us back.
That is true. They were almost like Shaggy Dog stories in some way, you know. It wasn't as though they had some inherent logic, and I have never been a writer, even if I write at more length, who's heavily reliant on plot. It really does have, to my way of thinking, more to do with the psychology of the characters. But I suppose for whatever reason, as things have gone on, I've found it more interesting, really, to talk about characters in their environment, whereas before, the environment, I think it was the cumulative effect, if you read a lot of my stories that made you sort of understand generally where these characters were, whether it be Vermont or New York City, obviously very, very different places. But I think now I would want that interplay. I would want, it's like a tuning fork. The character's part of it, and the other resonance is really the external world.
In the later stories, when you're dealing with the issues of age, there's one extraordinary story about a dinner called The Women of This World.
Mm-hmm. Lou Reed's song, I'm Just a Gift to the Women of This World.
How does a story like that start? It opens with a meal, but then proceeds.
Well, I can tell you a couple of things about that. None of them really account for the story because they're almost interchangeable with what happens to me and probably a lot of other people on a daily basis. And one is that I live in Maine in the summer, and imaginatively, I've looked at that field across from the house so very many times. There is no house down the field. There is nothing that would account for the exact plot of that story. But finally, for whatever reason, and that's what's so interesting to me about writing, that field resonated one day as being really loaded, literarily, you know, having some potential I hadn't thought about. The other thing is that, in fact, the poet Charles Simic is a good friend of my husband's and mine, and I had gotten a particular wine for him because he was coming to dinner in a couple of weeks. Meanwhile, I invited another friend over who had very particular tastes in wine and who pulled that out of the wine rack and said, why aren't we having this with dinner? And I was so stupid as to say, oh, that's a bottle of, you know, Italian red that I had gotten for the Simics. And he said, well, I would appreciate it if you'd open it. And in fact, we did open it, but, you know, that sparked something, too. I just started to put pieces together of things that I had recently tuned into.
That brings me to another question, is that when we're looking at these stories, just knowing that they're fictional characters doing fictional things, What autobiographical material could we pull out from those stories? I mean, are they just kind of speculations, or do some of these have the actual basis in your life?
The plot doesn't have any basis in my life, that's for sure. But everything that circles around, or almost sits there in lieu of plot, often has some sort of basis, and not necessarily even in my life. It could be something I've recently heard from a friend, or it could be something that's in the newspaper. It could be any number of things.
And the story about the guy with the pool in Los Angeles, which is different because I don't believe any other story takes place out there.
Well, I have friends who live in the Hollywood Hills, and fictionally that's set in their pool. And although I don't know if they have deer or not, they have other weird enough stuff like possums and raccoons and major wildlife right there, 5 minutes off of Hollywood Boulevard.
Well, I know we discussed this a moment ago about Roger Angel, who is still my favorite, absolute favorite sports writer
of all
time.
Oh, he would be very happy to hear that. And well, he might be.
Is there anything that makes something a New Yorker story?
It's a very difficult question. I don't think so, but you have to remember that the same thing that happened to me happened with other writers, too. In other words, there may be certain tendencies that writers have that the New Yorker was more likely to pick. I don't think probably every single word that, say, John Cheever ever wrote was necessarily published in the New Yorker, although probably statistically he had a much better batting average than I did with that sort of thing. You know, they may also not be so conscious of that. Or here's the advantage and the disadvantage of working very closely with one person. They are having a subjective reaction. They do like what they like, and they're less interested in other things. And sometimes writers can convert editors and vice versa, and sometimes not. But in other words, I'm not sure that the New Yorker didn't understand what my range was. It's just that they had an interest in a particular kind of revelation that I came to in certain stories. The very early stories, I think they thought that there were some clues about what was going on, and they liked the way I was articulating that. I wasn't solving the mystery by any means, but that I was asking the question at all and that I was of that world, I think I came along in a way at the right time.
It seems that in the late 60s and early 70s, the older establishment in literary and theatrical and film communities were trying to grasp what the hell was going on with the younger people. And, you know, you see signs of it in film occasionally where they hit it, a film like Easy Rider.
Mm-hmm.
But more often than not, you see films like What's New Pussycat?
Well, that was a pretty good film.
Well, but it didn't.
Yes, no, I know what you mean. It seemed not the thing itself somehow, an improvisation or played for laughs, obviously, with Peter Sellers. Yes, no, I agree with you. I'm much more in the spirit of Easy Rider. But also, I did take it for granted because I was of that world.
Did you always feel, as you were growing older, that you remained in that world? And I felt like I was part of something in the 70s. And now it's inchoate. It's indistinct.
Well, one thing I need to say is that really I was living among these people, but I wasn't your radical of radicals. I wasn't your druggie of druggies. I was the one who was the scribe. I was the one who was noticing all this stuff and writing it down, you know. So it's not as though it was merely autobiographical and I was projecting it forward in some fictional way. I was always a bit mystified and therefore not even tempted to try to solve something in writing that I couldn't solve in my everyday life. But I still feel very comfortable in Berkeley. I feel I still feel very comfortable in Vermont. You know what I mean? Maybe I just flatter myself at this point, but there are certain refrains that I think maybe still some interesting radical things can come out of.
I found a quote from you. I was an only child. It is often true of only children that they become watchers. I was thinking about that in terms of the stories, and a lot of the stories involve siblings. And my first thought was, wait, there are siblings. And then I realized, no, there's always somebody watching the siblings.
Oh, really? I never thought about that. I think you know them better than I do. That is very interesting. But, you know, the writer's position is always of the watchful child in a way. Watchful, I mean, the child is maybe a better analogy than finding some other, you know, adult functionary to talk about writers in terms of, because you have to feel somewhat like an outsider. If you felt like you already understood something, what would be the pleasure, what would be the personal payoff of just writing that?
Do you actually get an understanding necessarily from writing a story?
Not necessarily, but there have been individual moments. I don't know if that I have to come up with one exactly right this second. I'm going to be very good at it. But, yeah, there have been moments that I have not seen where the story was drifting, and as it drifts more into fact, I think, oh, that's what I think about that. That's why I'm putting that there, you know.
Well, at that point, do you pull back from the story and do you just flow with it?
Quite the opposite, yeah. One thing that does come to mind, of course, is the ending of a story of mine called The Burning House. And I think that was written either 1979, 1980, something like that. So quite a long time ago. But I had no idea where that story was going until the last paragraph of that story. Absolutely none. And then the wife asks the husband a question, and he answers her point blank. And I was so paralyzed by his answer, it was almost as though I really was the crazy person channeling voices instead of being in control of the story. But I thought, at the same time, I thought, I'm completely derailed. I also thought, this is great. This contains a clue. If I then bring my intelligence to bear on this, because that can't be the very last thing we hear, all it takes is one more line. Can I think of that other line that's fair enough, that doesn't just damn these people?
And did you find it?
Yeah.
And are you happy with that?
Yeah, the ending of The Burning House, yeah, I'm happy with it.
Do you ever look back on some of those stories and go, you know, it needed another paragraph, or maybe I should have stopped it a little bit sooner?
I look back, as you do, and see that some of them seem a little repetitive. But again, I don't often have reason to look at my earlier stuff. And
right.
Maybe if I look at it, you know, 10 years down the line, I'll have a different impression still about what's going on. I copy edited this book a couple of times, you know, just when the publisher sent it back to me. And reading them in chronological order was interesting.
The stories in those early days, they seem to me, and maybe I'm wrong, as if at a certain point they just stop, whereas the latest stories, they end. Does that make sense to you?
I'm not really trying to say that these were perfect works of fiction or anything like that with the early stories, but I don't myself see them as being arbitrary. That is to say, I didn't just write a line and think, oh, that'll do. They didn't seem arbitrary to me, but they seemed more like moments in time. And then I had a different standard, sort of, for how moments in time concluded than I do now for more of an explanation of someone's life. It really gets demonstrated right on the page.
Yeah, well, the term I was thinking of as I was reading them, and it just came to me now, is that they're more slice of life than those early stories.
And I think, too, that there was a lot of nuance and there was a lot, you know, off the page in those short early stories. But in a way, I don't think they were about a lot of subtext. They might have been about subculture. They might have been about, you know, one aspect of someone's psychology or something like that. But it does seem to me that what would have been much more covert in the subtext earlier is now more overt in the later stories, for better or for worse. Not that these characters can easily be figured out, but again, in that interplay between the people in the environment and so forth, you can see where the writer stands. You couldn't see really where I stood, except that I was taking an aerial view of things in those early stories.
And as I was reading the stories in the later ones, it has a lot to do with the fact that we follow characters through time in the later stories,
mm-hmm.
as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, coincidentally, the longer stories in this particular collection, the New Yorker stories, they're more embroidered. They're more bringing the strands of the story together. Probably that is not entirely representative of my more recent work. I write things that appear in other places. I write things
right.
that might appear in the Paris Review or, you know, some other publication. And I don't think probably if you looked at those vis-a-vis these stories, they would be quite as neat as some of these stories in the New Yorker stories.
Anne Beattie, before we went on the air, we were talking about consciousness of theme. And I mentioned that a lot of writers I know that I've spoken with say theme is for other people, and they might consider that after they've finished. And you said, oh, no, I think it can be both ways. You could either not consider the theme, or sometimes you actually do know the theme as you're writing it.
Yeah, but still I'm feeling my way into the material, even if I know the theme. In other words, if I'm aware of where I am in a story and I know I can project forward, I think I write almost entirely in visual terms. And so finding the field across my house, as I was saying earlier, or finding the milieu of the story is really the important thing. And it's what it provokes emotionally. It probably would provoke different emotional responses on different days, too.
In the story Thunderbird, for instance, now, that story struck me because that has a perfect ending. How did that one come to you? I mean, or was that ending there? I mean, I could see it being predicted early on, but
No ending has ever been there in my conscious mind. Yes,
really?
In a way, subconsciously, you do have to wonder when you get something like that as to whether, you know, you hadn't understood all along what way the material was loaded. But yes, that's about, you know, two people who have a very problematic relationship, but the thing they have in common is the Thunderbird, the vintage Thunderbird, a convertible that they have a great time in, and then precipitously the woman in the story sells the car, and she realizes she's made a mistake at the end, and she says to the not-quite-boyfriend, you know, maybe I could offer the guy more money than he paid me for it, maybe at least that way we could get it back. If you make a statement like that, you've got to realize that it's extremely evocative. And so you're lucky if you have something so inherently loaded that also seems part of natural speech. I mean, you do sense her vulnerability in that moment. And as the reader, you do know they've lost this for all time. And even if they get the Thunderbird back, there's something else hugely missing that she would never be able to buy back, you know. But those things that don't have superimposed literary intentions on them that just seem to come out of common speech, I really like those.
How does a story like Walks with Men compare to, say, the stories in the New Yorker book?
I don't think there's much comparison. It's so episodic, for one thing, and the stories in the New Yorker book, or the earlier ones, are relatively short. They do have asterisks in them. They do move through time. But Walks with Men is really almost, I'm not quite sure how many, but it's four or five distinct sections that I hope add up to a whole. So formally, it looks very different than the New Yorker stories at any point.
But it also is so much shorter than a novel.
Well, it is. Instead of the New Yorker stories, which had not at that point occurred to me, I had sent in a collection of maybe 13, 14, 15 new stories since my last collection to Scribner, and they were going to publish those. But for my editor, Nan Graham, who's a very wonderful reader, slipped that one out, and not just because of its length, but she really related to that. She really thought that might be a small, separate publication. And so I didn't send it earmarked as, here's a novella I wrote, you know, as in, look at this, this is special. That was her reaction to the book. She took that out of the book.
Now, would you have considered then that story being as one with the other 15 or so?
Yeah, I would have.
I interviewed you a decade ago, maybe, whatever it was, for Perfect Recall, and now you've had more work with longer forms and continued working with shorter forms. What is the relationship of working on a novel in that sense to working on short stories? Because you talked about some of the later stories, and certainly even Walks with Men, about creating more depth in the short stories. So are they just shorter versions of the novel? Are they something else?
Well, I don't for a minute truly compare myself to Alice Munro, but she would be a wonderful example of somebody who writes very long stories that in some way are wonderfully unwieldy. I mean, they open up to the world just because of their surface oddity in some ways. And as many people say about Munro, and I say the same thing, why would you read a novel when you could read this long story by Alice Munro? So I do think that you can pack the essence of what could be played out in a novel form into a long story. I'm not conscious of doing that in the moment. When I wrote that last Odd Day in L.A. that takes place in the Hollywood Hills, for example, I didn't know if that was going to be a 12-page story, a 35-page story, what that was going to be. I suspect that Munro knows. I mean, that she knows she works within an unusual version of the form, meaning very, very long stories that are very long stories. But a subjective answer to what you just said, for whatever reason, temperamentally, if I'm writing a novel, I have to give the secret wink to the reader that I know that even though this is of hundreds of pages, I still know that it's make-believe. There isn't any novel of mine I can say, except for the first one, which came out in 1976, so that's a heck of a long time ago. There isn't any novel that hasn't contained as part of it the undercutting of itself. Meaning, when, for example, I publish a novel called Falling in Place, there are italicized sections at the end of all of the chapters. And people were sort of, including my editor at the time, discombobulated by that. What is it? And they had started as working notes to myself of things I needed to incorporate. But I realized, as our jotted down notes and thoughts can be, they had a liveliness of their own. So really, I had one form competing with the more seriously considered form, meaning the body of the work. But it undercut it. But it also undercut it in a way that I thought was fair, and that you could sort of more see the workings of the writer's mind, and I'm talking about a paragraph. Sometimes it's only a sentence or two that divides the book. My most recent novel was called The Doctor's House, and it involves stories that were told in childhood between the brother and the sister, and they're there in italicized sections that force the reader to go back to childhood and to read something that's happening by proxy. But that, too, is sabotage of the main trajectory of the book. I don't sabotage myself in stories.
You use the phrase make-believe, that these are make-believe.
They are. In other words, I think sometimes people think, as readers, that there is a burden that is or is not met in some way by reading a novel. In other words, you know, the writer has devoted 250 pages to this. This must be a succinct worldview of the writer's. I don't know that they think that about an individual short story. They might fairly think that about the cumulative effect of them, but I don't think they think that way. Well, the answer is no, I certainly don't. It might be 250 pages, but it's interchangeable with me in terms of a snapshot.
Ah,
and that's
I
all I do is snapshots. Some of them are really maybe more complex snapshots in some way than others, but that's all I do is snapshots.
So in that sense, there is no difference except for length and complexity,
right.
But we're talking about right. The same form.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm just trying to sort of cover myself in a way. It's cowardice. I want people to know that I know that just because it's played at a great length, it's still only a story. It's interchangeable with a 10-page story.
The analogy would be if we watched Saturday Night Live back in its glory days and we'd see these great skits with different characters
yeah.
and one actor or actress, and then we see them doing one character in a movie, and we're going, wait a second, that's got to have more depth. But all that is, really, is just the same thing, only longer.
Yes, and of course, they're actors. They're actors. I have such envy, I think writers do, of what's visual. Not to say the movies are a superior form or anything like that, but boy, what you can give people in 3 seconds when they're looking at a visual scene in a movie, you know, you just have to write and write and write and write and write. And it takes up time to do that writing. I mean, it takes up time on the audience's part. So you're at odds with chronological time in literature. You're not at odds with it in a movie, necessarily.
But you're also able to more fully control the interiority, aren't you?
I would think so. That certainly would be one of the big advantages for me personally, yes. Because movies almost run away with meaning.
A friend of mine, Frank M. Robinson, who has written thrillers, he said the thing to keep in mind is that, in a way, you're writing a movie in someone else's head. And I don't know if that's really true.
I don't get the movie analogy that way. I do see the forms as being so distinct and each having advantages and disadvantages, you know. I'm a very visual person, but I don't personally, as a reader, read thinking I'm making a movie. I think I'm reading literature. And I'm particularly interested. I mean, here's something that comes up a lot of times when I'm teaching. Very smart students, too, literature. It really is that interesting thing that happens when writers echo the voice of another writer and literature's in dialogue with other literature. Certainly we're all used to like remakes of movies, whether it be True Grit or, you know, whether it be a sequel to something. We're all used to that. But movies are in dialogue with movies usually. Literature isn't in dialogue with movies. It's in dialogue with other literature.
Usually. I mean, I've seen occasionally where the allusions are to movies, and to me they fall flat
mm-hmm.
because I guess it mm-hmm. doesn't quite work. Where does theater fall into that, you think?
That's a very interesting question because you have to think about who really goes to see theater in the United States any longer. You know, who the audiences are. A couple of times last summer I went to see theater, and it was a bunch of gray hairs in the audience, and you know, I think also I'm not saying that the playwrights are writing directly toward those people or that there aren't plays that draw a younger audience. Certainly there are. But I think with literature, you just can't tell who's reading you, at what age they're reading you. And whatever their expectations, potentially they could be met, whereas people in the theater, I think, are pretty vulnerable or know in advance what it is that they're going to.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the name of the play. I just saw it. Is it ACT? Clinborne Park, in the booklet that ACT puts out, there's an article by the playwright who said that his job is to make audiences uncomfortable about race, and he's specifically gearing it to the audience who's going to show up.
Oh, interesting.
Older, middle-class, white people.
Interesting, yeah.
So that is true, whereas Do you think about the reader? No, you just write, right?
Oh, no. No, I'm not saying I'm trying to outguess the reader or that I really have a grip on who the reader is or anything like that. But in terms of structuring these stories, I do very much think about, will something work that one kind of audience that is very well read will get the allusions, for example, and then the story will expand in meaning. Okay, take that away. We're not always going to have that ideal audience. Does it still work?
Does it work on its own terms?
On its own terms, yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So when I say that sometimes I just read a story for character and plot and I'm not looking for theme, that story has to work on that level and on whatever other levels you want, but it has to work on that level.
It absolutely does, and I often think of Flannery O'Connor, who is so bright and wonderful and just puts things forth in such a straightforward way about writing. And, you know, in her essays, she talks about that. And to paraphrase her, she says, really, if there's no surprise for the writer, there's no surprise for the reader. But I think writers are surprised all the time. And really, you can make a pretty good guess at what point in the text they might have become surprised.
One question I ask a lot of writers is what kind of control they have over the story, over the characters. Sometimes writers will say the characters have taken over. And others say, that's a load of crap because I'm sitting there writing it. How does that seem to work for you?
Well, most of the writers I know, me included certainly, feel like it's a lucky accident that you do, in the moment, sort of seize up when a minor character starts to run away with your story. At the same time, that potentially could take it in a direction that you didn't have in the front of your mind and that you're probably not likely to act on unless you're willing to go scurrying after that character for a while. You can always revise. You can always reel the story back in. But if you don't find something that takes you outside of it, then maybe both consciously and subconsciously, it's all too much worked out in your mind. Wouldn't it be better to have something that does shake you up a little bit? I mean, wouldn't that inherently shake up the reader as well?
Have you ever thought, if a character does that, of taking that character out and giving that character his or her own space in another story?
Well, you know, my friend and colleague John Casey, who has a very wonderful book out now called Compass Rose, it's all about women, and he's using the characters from his earlier novel, Spartina, that won the National Book Award, and this is many years later, and how interesting. He's got his cast of characters, and they all occupy very, very different roles in this book, Compass Rose. So there are those who work that way. It doesn't tend to be very much... I can't think that I've ever done that in point of fact, no.
Do you ever have characters recur, maybe under different names, but as I was reading this book, I kept thinking, have I met this character before? Could I have met this character before in an early story under a different name or maybe even the same name?
Again, you know, writers are limited, too, because they only know what they know. So you're
right.
Always looking at something that's coming very subjectively out of that particular writer. And in terms of that writer's sensibility, therefore, I have a lot of madmen in my stories, and they are a type, capital letter T. And it would be fair enough to assume that there's a commonality there. But I would hope that I use them a bit differently. Even though that type comes easily to me, I would hope that literarily I'm able to have some range with that type.
I noticed in the latest stories, the final stories, dealing with elderly parents, adult children, people who are very conscious of age. And I think that's what we as baby boomers are going through right now. And as we move past 60 and get up there, we're starting to think about that. How does that affect, say, the stories that you tell?
Well, I'm sure it did affect them for quite a while. My parents both had strokes within a week of each other. My father was not in good health, but my mother seemed to be in excellent health, and she actually ended up worse than my father. And that really was my life for the better part of 10 years, and I am an only child. And so, of course, the environment that I was in hospitals, I was in nursing homes, I was in doctors' waiting rooms, and it would really be, how do you keep that out of your fiction?
It just goes in story after story after story, I noticed.
Yeah.
There's one story that says, I'm telling you the truth here.
Well, that story apparently convinced people so much. I was certainly not telling the truth there, by the way. And the character in it is named Anne. Are you talking about the story Find and Replace, about the character who rents a car and goes back to see her mother?
Right,
and
yeah.
Her father has died and the mother's having a romance with somebody else in the community. My mother did no such thing. That did not happen. But honestly, a very close friend of mine wrote me to give to my mother a letter of condolence because... the narrator in the story says, here's the facts, you know, my father died on whatever it is, Christmas Day or something like that, New Year's Eve, whatever I said. It was a letter of condolence, and this is a very sophisticated reader who read it as fiction in The New Yorker.
Colm Tobin, who has a wonderful collection called Empty Family, I just interviewed him like last month, and he told me that to throw people off, he actually has a couple of stories in that collection that are nonfiction that actually happened to him.
Wow. That's really interesting, because I have been known to take things into the classroom and to not say they aren't fiction and to say, what do you make of this? And it is very interesting how astute a discussion can be had in terms of fictional technique and so forth. And in fact, it's the introduction to a book or something like that, you know?
Speaking of teaching, in that sense, Ambiti, what kind of things can you teach? Are you just teaching literature? Are you teaching writing?
Yes, both. I teach one course in the contemporary American short story, which I like a lot because it's not a survey course in any way, and I just teach things that I'm very enthusiastic about. And I have writers grouped under particular categories. Between you and me, the American short story could not exist. Here's what many writers have in common that are very different. In their stories are, of course, cars, but also fluorescent lights and mantles. Who could believe it? If I had not gone into the classroom, I would not realize how often the mantle is mentioned in contemporary short stories. I know it sounds crazy, but now that I've told you, you'll start looking for this and you'll start seeing it. So I actually have stories that are called, you know, refrigerator stories, and I have stories that are called mantle stories, and it's all mixed up. What you can teach them is to be a more astute reader and also to realize certain things about the tone. I think particularly this generation, I miss many tonal things that they pick up. They miss a lot of tones that I hear there, and I think I can actually tell them why I'm hearing those tones or what's going on some of the time. So that's actually very gratifying, and it changes year to year with the graduate students because they're very different students from year to year for whatever reason, so I'm always on my toes. There you can teach them close editing, and you also can say something, not in a commercial sense about who's your audience, but maybe subtly suggest sometimes that they need to make some compromises, not to the detriment of their work, but just in terms of sheer comprehension.
My thought always came back to, if I'm reading something, I don't know what the person is saying, it's their fault, not mine.
Mostly I agree with you. Things certainly can go right past me. I remember going to see the movie Eyes Wide Shut, and I had never read the book it was based on, but I just disliked the movie, and I certainly thought I understood what I disliked. And then whoever wrote the review in The New Yorker, I read it, and I thought, no, I stand corrected, I see.
Ann Beatty, we talked before about film and theater. Have you ever thought about writing screenplays or plays?
No, I really haven't. I understand that dialogue just takes on too much weight, too much meaning in a lot of ways when that's primarily what the text relies on. I need that moving back and forth between exposition and dialogue and everything else I can do with the story to really form something that I'm sure has the kind of coherence that I want it to have. I would be very lost if I had to rely exclusively on dialogue, even though it's a thing that comes easily to me.
What do you have working on now?
Well, believe it or not, I am working on a book that's coming out next November that Scribner is publishing called Mrs. Nixon. It's such a cross-genre book that I'm going to have to be a lot more coherent by the time next November rolls around, but it is a thoroughly researched book about Mrs. Nixon, in which Mrs. Nixon is appropriated as a character partly in fictional settings and partly just in terms of how I read pictures of her that really appeared or statements in other people's books about her. Very interesting to look at Mrs. Nixon, kind of a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead of Hamlet. You know what I mean? That Tom Stoppard play just blew me away when it first came out, and I still love it. As I got older, I thought more and more about the person that was always in the background with Nixon, Mrs. Nixon. And so I started reading books I never read at the time, nonfiction books about Richard Nixon, and reading for where Mrs. Nixon appeared and how she was handled.
Ann Beatty, are we going to see those 15 short stories come out in a book soon?
Oh, I hope. I hope Scribner will do it, but I don't have any contract for that now. Mrs. Nixon's the last book that Scribner's bringing out that I know of.
You've been listening to an interview with Ann Beatty, whose latest book is The New Yorker Stories, which contains 48 stories over 32 years. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.